VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Tuesday is Election Day in the U.S., and the presidential race is shaping up to be extremely close, with potentially even tighter margins than Joe Biden's narrow win in 2020. Reuters correspondent Joseph Axe explains.
Polls are showing that this is likely to be one of the closest elections in U.S. history between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. There are seven states that are considered battlegrounds. Every single one of those states is essentially tied, according to the polls, with very small margins in one direction or the other. There are a lot of people who vote by mail. In a couple of the swing states, particularly Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, state law doesn't allow election officials to touch those votes until Election Day. Even in states like Arizona and Nevada, where workers are allowed to start processing and tabulating mail ballots before Election Day occurs, it still takes a really long time just because of the sheer volume. So a host of reasons are going to contribute to what's going to be a long time before we can actually say who won this election.
Reuters correspondent Joseph Axe. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said Monday that officials, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, are greatly concerned about the partnership between North Korea and Russia.
You saw the secretary speak to the fact on Thursday that North Korea has deployed as many as 10,000 troops to Russia, and that we were concerned that they would move to the front lines to enter the fight against Ukraine. As the secretary said on Friday, that as many as 8,000 North Korean troops had made their way to Kursk. We now assess that as many as 10,000 have made their way to Kursk and could enter combat in the coming days.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has neither confirmed nor denied the North Korean troops' presence. This is VOA News. Israel's foreign ministry said Monday the country has officially notified the United Nations that it was canceling the agreement that regulated its relations with the main UN relief organization for Palestinian refugees, UNRWA. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan has more.
UNRWA has been the main UN relief organization for Palestinian refugees since 1967, providing education and aid services to millions in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. But last month, the Israeli parliament passed legislation banning it from operating in Israel and stopping Israeli authorities from cooperating with the organization. Since the start of the war in October last year, Israel has maintained UNRWA has been deeply infiltrated by Hamas, accusing some of its staff of taking part in the October 7 attack on Israel. The UN said in August that 9 UNRWA staff may have been involved in the Hamas attack and had been fired. Israel's legislation has alarmed some of its Western allies and the United Nations. They fear it will further worsen the already dire humanitarian situation in Gaza, where Israel has been fighting Hamas militants for over a year. The Israeli Foreign Ministry said activity by other international organizations would be expanded.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu on Monday ordered the release of 29 children facing the death penalty after being arraigned for allegedly participating in protests against the country's worst cost of living crisis in a generation. The children were arraigned Friday and have been in detention since August. Activists say they were illegally picked up and have been put through horrifying experiences. Their arraignment sparked outrage and renewed concerns about deteriorating human rights in Africa's most populous country. Indonesia's National Disaster Management Agency says that at least 10 people have died as a series of volcanic eruptions widens on the remote island of Flores. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
The eruption at Mount Lewotobi Laki-Laki around midnight spewed thick brownish ash into the air and hot ashes hit several villages, burning down houses. The volcano's lava blanketed nearby villages and towns with tons of volcanic debris and forced residents to flee. Some, however, weren't lucky enough to escape, and emergency services came to recover their bodies as relatives wept nearby. Authorities said at least 10,000 people in 10 nearby villages have been affected by the eruption. I'm Karen Chamas.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
We'll be right back. Welcome to VOA's live coverage of the 2024 U.S. election. Later today, Tuesday, polls will be closing at various times in states around the country. We'll talk live with VOA reporters at the headquarters of former President Donald Trump, headquarters in Florida, with VOA reporters at various locations in battleground states, and we've got analysis for you live, so let's get to it. With me tonight in our Washington, D.C. studios is VOA Daybreak Africa host James Buddy. And in the southern U.S. battleground state of Georgia, we've got VOA reporter Anthony Labruto. Anthony, I understand you got a fairly well-known Republican member of Congress today who has been a strong supporter of Donald Trump speaking with you. What did you talk about?
Hi, Carol. Yes, I got the chance to actually speak, like you said, with one of former President Donald Trump's closest legislative partners in Congress, and that's Matt Gaetz from Northern Florida. And so certainly as the possibility of another Trump presidency could very well be imminent in the next couple of days, those close to him are really thinking that popular America First strategy used a lot during his first term. So I asked Gaetz what he would do to reassure U.S. allies that a second term for Donald Trump wouldn't be cause for concern for the country's closest allies. Take a listen.
I think people around the world should know that President Trump will bring peace. There was peace during the last Trump presidency because he wasn't always the most predictable foreign policy actor. And we've seen the way paint-by-numbers foreign policy allows our adversaries to be more hostile in the Middle East. We've seen Putin more aggressive in Europe. We've seen China more aggressive in the East. And so I think that we're going to have all kind of opportunity to reset deterrence, to give our military the tools that they need, and ensure America always holds the high ground.
Well, I'm sure Democrats in Congress would say that the unpredictable nature of Donald Trump is not a good thing when it comes to working with allies and forming U.S. foreign policy on critical issues around the world. James?
I understand that you got a chance to speak to a number of Trump and Harris supporters in Georgia. What can you tell us?
Absolutely, James. So in speaking with those Trump and Harris supporters at rallies that were both in Cobb County and kind of the greater Atlanta metropolitan area, both had kind of the same emotion. You might be able to hear it kind of in their voices. And that was frustration. You know, there definitely was a frustration among the American electorate here in Georgia that not enough is being done to solve their problems. You know, those problems, although, you know, each side will say would be completely different from what the other side, I think represents an underlying energy that is really driving people to the polls here for the general election. But let's listen to them now.
The biggest issue, of course, for me is women's rights. I know there are big issues, but for me, it really is important for me to be able to have control over what I do. Roe versus Wade being overturned after so many years is really upsetting. I have many nieces. I only have a son, but I have a lot of nieces. And I really would like for them to be able to make their own decisions.
You know, I realize that when one president leaves, kind of like the leftover is what we're dealing with. And he left it a mess. You know, when President Biden took office, it was a mess. And we saw that. And people were like, he gave me $1,000. No, that didn't really. We're paying it back now, right? And what's driving me to vote now is because I want the next generation to see why it's so important.
So a lot of the issues that impact me, it's a worldwide issue. I've been deployed. I've been overseas. I know how we stand as far as, like, how America looks on a global stage. And I know how we feel here within our country as well. So for me, it's not just, like, one single issue.
Of course, the economy and the rising costs are really difficult. And in addition to that, the border crossings, the illegal immigrants, and drugs.
Basically, the biggest thing that has resonated with me as a voter is the economy. That is the main issue on everybody's mind in this election. It doesn't matter if you're black, white, blue, or green. The main issue in this election is the economy. Of course, the border as well. We do want to protect the border. And the bottom line is we feel that Mr. Donald Trump is the best president for the economy.
Well, there's a lot of situations, but I think the biggest is probably the economy and the economy, public safety, and national security are my three biggest issues.
Just some of the voices that we have heard today from Trump and Harris supporters in Georgia, gathered by our own VOA's Anthony Labruto. Thanks, Anthony. We look forward to hearing from you again on Wednesday on the latest from Georgia.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And on the line with us is Charlie Giroux. He is a longtime Republican delegate from the battleground state of Pennsylvania, a big swing state with 19 delegates up for grabs. Charlie, what are you hearing from your fellow Republicans in Pennsylvania as the polls get close to closing around the country?
The biggest battleground state with 19 electoral votes, and Republicans in Pennsylvania are very excited because we believe that Donald Trump's going to carry the state tomorrow, and with it, the presidency.
Charlie, this is James Barté. What battleground states do you see as part of the winning equation for your candidate, Donald Trump, to get to 270 electoral college votes, the number of the candidate needs to win this election in the electoral college?
Well, I think he's going to exceed 270 votes, electoral votes, by a fairly significant margin. But I think you'll see Pennsylvania and the so-called blue wall go his way. I think he'll pick up North Carolina and Georgia, where you were just talking to some voters. And I believe he'll pick up Arizona as well.
Yeah, Charlie, just for the sake of our audience, tell them what the blue wall is, what you're referring to.
Yeah, I keep forgetting that we're talking to an audience that may not know the United States geography as well as you all. The blue wall is a string of several states across the industrial northeast of the United States where manufacturing was the king once upon a time and where there's been a tremendous loss of jobs, et cetera, over the course of the past 40 or 50 years. That's not something that just recently happened. It's Pennsylvania, Ohio, but you kind of skip over Ohio to Michigan and Wisconsin.
Right.
That's typically what forms the blue wall.
Okay, thanks, Charlie. You are listening to our special U.S. election coverage today with our news program. With me here is James Buddy. Remember, for more election coverage, you can check out voaafrica.com and voanews.com. Find us all on your favorite social media platforms as well. Also with us on the line is VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Pasutti, who is in West Palm Beach, Florida, near the home of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. Carolyn, let's put the same question to you. Kind of, we were going to speak to Patsy Whitaker-Squara, our White House bureau chief, earlier, but we could not get a hold of her right now at the Harris campaign headquarters. She will be stationed there later on in a few hours. What is the mood like there in Florida around the Trump headquarters?
Well, good morning, Carol, to you. I'm about two blocks away from where Trump's headquarters will officially be gathering at the Palm Beach County Convention Center. Now, why Palm Beach? Well, basically, Mar-a-Lago is the home of Melania and Donald Trump, and that is only a couple kilometers away from this convention center. So this entire Palm Beach County is Trump area, right? And in fact, Donald Trump is expected to vote tomorrow at his precinct. Or tomorrow, for you all, it's still the same day, but for us, it is tomorrow on Tuesday. He's expected to vote. And then they'll all gather there for an election watch party and celebration. And it will actually be Donald Trump, his entire family, Melania Trump, also his aides, his staff, his volunteers, and plenty of the media. And we will be there. We have credentials to get in the convention hall. Across the street from the convention hall, there is what's called a freedom of expression area, and that is for protesters. That will be in the grassy median in between two lanes of traffic. And that is where security has stepped in to really make sure that this convention hall will be secure tomorrow. They have erected extremely tall metal fences along this highway, and they have lessened the lanes from four to two so that it's more or less a road tunnel that is in front of this convention hall. And again, just for security's sake. But, you know, Donald Trump finished the day today in Michigan. He was also in North Carolina and Pennsylvania. I know you've talked about the swing states, Pennsylvania being the state to watch with 19 electoral votes. That's where Harris visited five cities today. Now, remember, these seven states could hold the key to the election, and that's what we're going to be watching tomorrow. What Donald Trump, though, is trying to do toward the end of this campaign is trying to get out young male voters. About a week and a half ago, he was on the Joe Rogan podcast. That's 80% male listeners, and this Joe Rogan podcast is number one podcast on Spotify. He just endorsed Trump
Yeah, I was just going to say they get he's got millions of viewers, right? Or listeners.
Right. But the real key is getting these voters motivated to vote. It's these young male white voters that don't normally go to the polls. So those are really the keys that Trump is looking for, these swing states and also these young white male voters.
Carolyn, this is James Botte. Former President Trump and his supporters, how are they going to be watching the numbers roll in for each state?
They're definitely going to be watching the swing states, as I mentioned, but they're also going to be watching specific states. They've always said that one of their slogans is Harris broke it, Trump will fix it, right? And they don't really say what Harris broke, right? And so they've been really centering on immigration and economy. And those are the two things that could turn these swing states. And so they're specifically going to be looking toward Pennsylvania, everybody is. But also North Carolina is really big, and also Michigan. So I think when they see those results coming in, that's when they're going to more or less decide how the night's going to be. Now, you know, that we can't really look at the polls. We've seen polls have failures in the past, and these polls have consistently showed such a very close race in this country. But I heard an expert today say, you know, you can't really trust these polls. These polls don't really show us what a close race it is. It's just that we don't know what's going to happen in this election. And I thought that was an interesting analysis.
Yeah, I've read things like that too. Like, you know, a lot of people who are counted on analysts and presidential historians at this time, you go to those kinds of folks, and no one seems willing to say this is how it's going to go. And some even say, yeah, you could see in any one of these seven battleground states, you could see a blowout for one or the other, but we just can't see it right now. And polls can be fluky, you know.
Right. Right, and we can talk about, you know, the blue wave. We can talk about the red mirage being that, you know, when you first get the results in, it kind of skews toward Donald Trump and the Republican end. But then when the larger cities come in, they skew toward the Democrats. So, you know, and that's what's called a red mirage. So we could get into that minutia, but honestly, at the end of the day, we might not know who won, and most of the experts say it's really too close. So we're not going to know by Tuesday night. It is going to continue, and we'll continue to see the results pour in Tuesday night into Wednesday. So we may be here for the long run. I'll be with you guys on the air.
Yep. Get ready for lots of pizza, and I hope you brought your sleeping bag, Carolyn.
Right.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Lots of water.
Let's go to VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, who is in Lawrenceville, Georgia. Steve, you are in one of the seven states where polling has said for weeks now that it's too close to say which presidential candidate is on top, or at least within the margin of error. What have the latest polls been saying about Georgia in particular? And separately, can you tell us what this Georgia Supreme Court ruling was earlier today regarding the election?
Well, you're right. This is one of the key states, Georgia, southeastern United States, and I am focused on one particular county, which is known as a bellwether, which is seen as absolutely critical for winning the state of Georgia. And Georgia has 16 of those electoral votes. You need 270 to win the presidency. Only Pennsylvania has more, 19, and North Carolina also has 16 votes. And this is also a very interesting place. It is one of the most ethnically diverse counties in the southeastern United States. It is divided pretty evenly among Asians, African Americans, Hispanic population, and only about one out of three voters in this county are white. And that diversity very much reflects the country at large. And what I was talking today with Gwinnett County's election supervisor, who was telling me, as a result of some of the recent machinations that have gone on between lawmakers and the courts, that they will be able to start counting several hundred thousand, or actually releasing the tabulations. They've already started the counting but they can't push the button for the tabulations until 7 p.m. tomorrow when the polls close. And we may know very quickly a significant percentage of the outcome of the votes for this election tomorrow.
Steve, this is James Botti. Let's turn to the Senate races. There are a number of incumbent senators who are not running for re-election, and that could mean that Democrats could lose control of the Senate. Why is it important which party controls the Senate, especially when it comes to U.S. foreign policy?
Right. Well, but the president does have a significant amount of power in the United States. They can sign executive orders, but they cannot make laws. And frequently these executive orders that the president produces are overturned by the courts. But the Congress, which is the upper house is the Senate and the lower house is the House of Representatives, they have what's called the power of the purse. So any money that's going to be spent by the government needs to be approved by the Congress. And, of course, that can be very extensive. That can be money that goes, for example, to help out Ukraine fight off the Russians, to supply weapons to Israel in that battle against groups such as Hezbollah and Hamas. And also the U.S. Senate has a role in confirming ambassadors and other important presidential appointees. And whoever controls the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, obviously whatever party is in control there, whether it's the president's party or the party opposed to the president, can have a tremendous amount of power in the foreign projection of the United States.
U.S.-Africa relations are also important, too, right? And that comes up before the Senate.
Correct. Almost anything that deals with foreign relations will come through that Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And what's very different now, I think, compared to decades past, the Senate was traditionally regarded as more of a gentleman's club. It was back in an era where there were not really women in the U.S. Senate. And those leaders from the opposing parties would get together and work out deals for the good of the nation, sometimes agreeing with what the president wanted to go along with, even if some of those senators weren't in the president's party. There's much less of that bipartisan cooperation these days. It's almost like sometimes it's a zero-sum game, as they say. So it's even more critical to have control of the Senate. And if a president doesn't have his own party in control of the Senate, getting his foreign policy objectives through and to be successful in that arena, whether it's in regards to Africa, Asia, wherever, is going to be very challenging.
Thanks, Steve. That's Steve Herman, our VOA's chief national correspondent, joining us live from Gwinnett County, Georgia. And speaking of the congressional races, a woman could be elected for the first time in the House or Senate in several states, not to mention that if Vice President Harris wins, she would be the first woman president, first black woman president, and first Asian American president. A few hours ago, I spoke with Wendy Schiller, professor of public and international affairs at Brown University in Rhode Island and director of the Taubman Center for American Politics and Policy. We talked about how women are expected to make a big difference in this election. Here's our conversation.
This could be a year of many firsts for women in the U.S. Congress, including your own state of Rhode Island. Can you tell us a little bit more about these races when we talk about the House and Senate, and especially the U.S. Senate? There's more than a handful, right, of women running for U.S. Senate?
There are incumbents running in Wisconsin. Tammy Baldwin's running for re-election. And we also have Jackie Rosen in Nevada running for re-election. There are still only 25 out of 100 seats in the United States Senate held by women. There are many more women in the House of Representatives, I think about 128 women in the House of Representatives. The Republicans have far fewer women in the House of Representatives. This election year could change that. There are more Republican women running, and they may be able to secure some of these competitive seats. We also have an open race in Michigan. We had a female senator, Debbie Stabenow, and now a Democrat, Alyssa Slotkin, is running to replace her. So that wouldn't be a net gain for women. But I think the Democrats are trying to hold the line on the seats they have that are held by women, particularly in Senate races. We're seeing, you know, very few governors are women. That's the one area where the United States has really lagged behind. I believe the number is almost 9 women, I think, maybe even a few more than that, but not many more than that out of 50 states our governors are women. And so when you think about that, they're split about evenly between Republicans and Democrats. So having a woman capture the White House would really be a game changer, I think, for women leaders at the executive level, especially given how few we have at the governor's level now.
You know, in our way of Congress and elections, the members of the House of Representatives run every time we have an election. But in the Senate, it's not that way. They run every 6 years. And this year, I think it's less than a third that are up for election or else, you know, new people running, right?
Yeah, there are 100 Senate seats, and they're usually anywhere from 33 to 36 open seats every 2 years. The framing of the Constitution and the Founding Fathers did that on purpose. They really wanted to separate the electoral incentives of the 2 senators that serve from each state. So they wanted to guarantee that one would get elected in 1 year, and then a couple of years later, the other senator would be up for re-election, so that you would have some differences in who they represent and how competitive they would be instead of being a team from the state. So that was a decision made in the framing of our Constitution and the founding of our country. And it really has ramifications for women. We have a couple of delegations that have all women senators, notably Nevada, the state of Nevada, 2 Democratic women, and also the state of Washington have 2 Democratic women, and the state of Minnesota has 2 Democratic women.
Speaking of women still, after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the landmark Roe v. Wade decision, guaranteeing a woman's right to reproductive health care, including an abortion in this country if she wants one, abortion has become a key issue for Democrats and Republicans, depending on how you see it. Are women more likely to vote on this issue than in the past because of this particular issue? Are you likely to see more women coming out? And also, what about other issues that are motivating women to come out and vote?
In 2024, we're seeing really interesting dynamics. A lot of observers were really focusing on younger women, women of childbearing age, and thinking, well, this Dobbs decision will really bring them out in big numbers. And we did see more college age and 20-something women voting in 2022, the congressional midterm elections. What's interesting about 2024 is that women over the age of 65 are voting in large numbers. So 72% of all people over the age of 65 in America vote, those who are registered to vote. But women seem to be coming out on that age quite a bit over the issue of abortion, because they've experienced the United States when there was no right to an abortion. Then they experienced the United States with a right to abortion, and now it's been restricted or taken away in a lot of states.
That was Wendy Schiller, professor of public and international affairs at Brown University in Rhode Island. She's also director of the Taubman Center for American Politics and Policy. She was speaking to me earlier today. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about the U.S. election in this special live programming from our Washington, D.C. studios. Our thanks to our many VOA reporters who joined us live tonight, and our analysts Charlie Giroux in Pennsylvania and Wendy Schiller in Rhode Island. I'm Carol Van Dam, along with VOA Daybreak Africa host James Buddy. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow for more VOA English to Africa special live coverage of the U.S. election. And this evening, turn into Africa News Tonight for a special hour-long election news program. You are listening to The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Linor Mudu, host of Health Chat. Join me for the latest in health news, wellness tips, medical breakthroughs, and much more. Our experts inside the United States and beyond will share some insights on living a healthy life. Tuesdays at 17:30 UT.